This is Gulf Coast State College, Anatomy and Physiology, Fluid, Electrolyte, and Acid-Base Balance, Part 2. We finished last time by talking about the major cations in body fluids. So now let's go ahead and do some of the major anions in body fluids. I remember the anions are negative ions because what I draw at home on my paper is I make a big capital N right there, and then I never forget that the anions are negative. These are the anions we'll look at. We'll look at the first several in that order, starting with the chloride anion. The slides are set up the same way, similar to what we just had done with the cations. So starting at the top, chloride ions, you have to know the chemical symbol once again. Location, it is the most abundant extracellular anion. Functions, well, let me keep this simple. If you know sodium, you essentially know chloride. For example, main function here accompanies sodium in osmosis because, you know, water follows the salt. I'll add one more here. It also helps form the HCl in your stomach. And I'm sure if I asked you what HCl was, you could tell me it's hydrochloric acid and the Cl is the chloride part of it, a very strong acid inside of our stomach. As far as control, it's easy. You just write down right here, same as sodium, and we'll keep it as simple as that. The next anion will be the phosphate ion, that's HPO42-. If anybody asks you, most phosphate in the body is found in the bone matrix and teeth as calcium phosphate salts, that is, as a solid. However, this is the ion part of the course. So, if you are asked where phosphate ions are floating around as charged particles in the body fluids, you will say they are mostly intracellular. As far as functions go, this is mostly old news. You know that phosphate is in your bones and in your teeth from ANP1. You studied nucleic acids, including DNA and RNA, and you remember that a phosphate group was part of those nucleic acids. Also, ATP, an old friend of yours, the P represented, of course, phosphate. The only new function on this slide is that of a buffer, and I have a slide dedicated just to the function of phosphate as a buffer. So that brings us to control. And once again, it comes down to vitamin D. Vitamin D increases the dietary absorption of both phosphates and calcium. And once again, that's why they put it in the milk. You need the calcium and phosphate to get absorbed. You got to get it in your bones and teeth. And the vitamin D is the key there. Bicarbonate ions, HCO3-. Mainly an extracellular anion. The function, it helps regulate acid-base balance in the blood plasma. That is, it is a buffer. I just remember bicarb is a big buffer in the blood. And it's so important, I have a whole slide dedicated just to that. So we'll talk about that in a little bit. As far as control, going to make it easy on you. Right in here, just go ahead and put in kidneys again or renal. And you can almost say that and be right for anything in the body like we discussed in the last section, because the kidneys generally do control mostly kind of what stays in or what gets out. The kidneys are really smart, though. I kind of put in a little quotation there in slang. It says, make new and save old. That means, in technical terms, the kidneys can actually manufacture new bicarbonate from scratch, or it can decide to hold on to any old bicarbonate that's already floating around in your blood. So if you need bicarbonate, kidneys can make it from scratch or decide not to pee it out. This is the slide I was promising you, because as you were studying the cations and the anions, probably the hardest thing to remember is which ones are extracellular and which ones are intracellular. So I made this slide up here, and it's a good way to group them from a practical standpoint. You will see how important this is when we get to neurophysiology. So here we go. The most common extracellular ions in order are sodium, chloride, bicarbonate, and calcium. How do I remember that? I just write down on a sheet of paper and my notes off to the side, I write NBC. The N stands for the sodium chloride, the B stands for bicarbonate, and the C stands for calcium. And there's two ways to remember this. NBC, of course, that's a television network. And I just think of it this way. I'm not saying that this is true. I'm just using this as a memorization technique. Think of the shows on NBC as kind of being way out there on the fringe. So if I remember the shows on NBC are kind of out there, I remember the NBCs are extracellular. Another way to remember it, if you don't like that one, kind of goes like this. Has anybody ever licked their sweat? Well, you don't have to admit it or certainly do it. But if you ever did that, it tastes kind of salty, doesn't it? And, of course, the sweat is outside your cells. So I remember the salty stuff is extracellular. So sodium chloride is salty. That's extracellular. Bicarbonate, which is basically baking soda. Let's assume it tastes kind of salty. Don't go home and taste the baking soda out of the box, but let's assume it tastes kind of salty. And calcium, let's say if you could taste that, it also tasted kind of salty. So the salty stuff is also extracellular. Easy to remember the salty sweat. And the two most important ones I want you to know I have green stars on. You must know the most common extracellular ions are sodium as the most common cation and chloride as the most common anion. That's why I put stars next to them. How about the most common intracellular ions? In order, they are potassium, phosphate, protein anions, and magnesium. How do I remember that? Got a little technique. You can write this down on your paper as you're making notes. I just remember PPP, because they all start with P. PPP poking inside my cells. Furthermore, I look at the M. M is really for magnesium, but there's also a show, a movie, came out again recently, I think, called The Three Musketeers. So I remember the PPP are the Three Musketeers, and the M stands for the Musketeers. So that's kind of a weird mnemonic, and it might help it stick. Just one I use for my little pea brain. What do you got to know, stone cold, though? Once again, it's got a green star on it. You must absolutely know that the most common intracellular anion, particularly cation, is potassium. We'll see how important that is when we get to neurophysiology. On the bottom of the slide, I have a couple of root words. I hope you know what hyper and hypo means. If I say on the test someone has hypercalcemia, that means they have too much. If I say they have hypocalcemia, that means they have too little. These next two slides are a couple of tables. calm down, relax, don't get nervous. You don't have to memorize the tables, but it's just fascinating to me. I suggest you glance through them in your leisure time. Take a look at the different ions. Look at the tight ranges we live in. I'll scan down here to potassium. Look, that'll come back on the chart, and it's supposed to be in between 3.5 and 5.0. And if you look at the problems that could come from abnormalities, over here it says if you have too much, you can die from heart rhythm problems. If you have too little, you could become paralyzed. So what I want you to gather from this table and the next table is we live in really tight ranges. It's critical to check these when they come back on the charts and, of course, report any abnormalities right away. Otherwise, these tables are just for you. But it's amazing to look at all the different problems that are caused by electrolyte imbalances. And that's why you see the lab slips come back on the charts hundreds of times a day on your patients. Now we get to one of my favorite things actually in the whole course. Acid-base balance. And on this slide here, I want you to write a few big picture items. Number one, your body cells are making acid all day, every day. You better get rid of it or you don't make it to the next day. Another thing is, how does acid cause problems? How can it damage or even kill us? It mostly does it by something we call denaturing, to denature our proteins. So write that down, denature. Denature basically means to change the shape. You recall back in ANP1, you learned the primary, the secondary, the tertiary, and the quaternary structure of proteins. Well, proteins are pretty important. They make up many parts of our body, including enzymes. And enzymes are necessary to make almost every chemical reaction take place in our body. If you change the shape, if you denature them, they don't work and your body cells don't work. That's how critical acid-base balance is. Another thing I ask students to write down at this point in time on a piece of paper is just draw a straight line. At one end of the line on the left, draw an A. At the far end of the line on the right, draw the letter B. Because that line represents going from acid to base. Because you have to know the pH scale. The pH scale goes from 0 to 14. Write a 0 on the acid side right under your capital A, and write a 14 on your base side right under that capital B. And right in the middle, draw a little hash mark in the middle of the line and write neutral, because neutral's in the middle, isn't it? And for blood, I want you to write down neutral, at least for blood, is 7.35 to 7.45. So make sure you write that line down. And I suggest when you're taking a test, write that line down. Write it down on the test. And it will keep you from confusing yourself on acid-base problems. So that's a nice little trick that will go a long way. In the body, there's two types of acids. One type is called volatile. One is called non-volatile. We'll talk about each of those in that order. This is just the organizational slide, of course. So first comes the volatile acids. What does that mean, volatile? That means an acid that can leave solution and enter the atmosphere. Let me try to put that into English. I'll try to give some examples of volatile solutions you may have heard of. Maybe you've seen a jar of pure ethanol. If you look at the sort of the surface, you might see some fumes coming off the top or vapors. that's actually the alcohol vaporizing or evaporating into the atmosphere. That certainly is a volatile solution. Or how about gasoline? Many of us have seen jugs of gasoline, and if you look at an open jug of gasoline, you see the fumes coming off the top. Again, it's vaporizing, it's evaporating, it's leaving the solution and entering the atmosphere. That's another great example of what a volatile solution is. The good news for the course, there's only one volatile example in the whole human body, and that's carbonic acid. You got to circle that or highlight that. Its chemical formula is H2CO3, and I do want you to know the chemical formula. And we can eliminate that acid from the body by breathing out carbon dioxide. Why? Because H2CO3 can break down into water and carbon dioxide in the lungs, and we can breathe it out. This is a very important big picture bullet point that will help you in the real world as well as in the testing situation. Please, when you think of breathing out carbon dioxide, think of that as breathing out acid. When you breathe out carbon dioxide, you breathe out acid. You'll even hear that referred to in the ICU. The attending physician will come around and check maybe the blood gases, including the pH on Mr. Jones, and might say, oh, the acid is too high in the blood. We have to get Mr. Jones to blow off more acid. Let's turn up the ventilator settings. Let's get him to breathe deeper and faster. Very important. There's a chemical formula at the bottom of the slide. I'm not going to ask you to regurgitate the formula on the test, but you should know the players. You should know that H2CO3 is carbonic acid. Of course, you also know that H2O is water. This, after all, is ANP2, and that's kind of ANP0. And then carbon dioxide, of course, is CO2. Let me give you some more examples of this because this is just so important to understanding how the human body works. Many of you, like my daughter, may have worked in a restaurant. You may have been responsible for making the soft drinks. And usually they have kind of a canister of the syrup, and then they have a canister of gas. And then you mix them together, do all the piping and pipe them all together. And you put the gas in the syrup to make the soft drink. And if you were paying attention, the gas is actually CO2. You're bubbling CO2 into the syrup and actually kind of driving this equation the other way. And you're putting carbonic acid into the soft drink by forcing in the carbon dioxide under high pressure. So, when you pop the top, let's say, on a can of a soft drink, and you hear that psst sound, what is that? Well, that's the gas. That's carbon dioxide coming out, sort of evaporating into the atmosphere. So what? Well, that's kind of like breathing. When you pop that top, think of that like breathing. Out comes the carbon dioxide. Out comes the acid. So if you let that can of soft drink sit out overnight and take a sip of it, what does it taste like? You're saying it's flat, right? It lost its zip. It lost its zing. It's lost the tang. It lost the acid. So that's another really good way to remember that. Then there are acids in the body called non-volatile acids. To make it easy, it's every other acid besides carbonic acid. These are acids that do not leave solution. Remember all the metabolic reactions you studied back in ANP1? They can produce non-volatile acids. sulfuric acid, hydrochloric acid, pyruvic acid, lactic acid. And the only way those other acids can be removed from the body are by the organs called the kidneys, which I slapped a pretty picture of one down here on the bottom of the slide. Now we can start to slowly but surely get to the good stuff. We want to be in balance, homeostasis. So let's talk about acid-base balance. You must know, for real life and for the tests, normal arterial blood pH is 7.35 to 7.45. You'll measure it. If you've ever seen a blood sample taken for pH, called a blood gas sample, they stick that needle usually into the radial artery. It is a bit uncomfortable, to say the least, for the patient, and bright red blood comes out of there, and you send it off for these tests, including pH. And if someone is acidic, that means the pH of their fluid is too low. If you drew your line like I asked you to a few slides back, you'll never miss that. If someone is alkaline or basic, those terms are synonyms. That means the pH of the fluid is too high. Now, we got to be in balance. How does the body control this? There are three mechanisms in the body we'll talk about. Buffer systems, exhalation of carbon dioxide, and kidney excretion of hydrogen ions, which represent, of course, acid. We'll talk about each of these one at a time in that order. That's how I like to organize my slides. Not just for you, but for my pea brain as well. And what this says, if you like to put this into slang, three ways to take care of our acid-base problems. You can buffer it, you can breathe it out, or you can pee it out. Before I talk to you about all those mechanisms, I'll stress the importance of it. Have any of you heard of a disease called DKA? That stands for diabetic ketoacidosis. These are usually really sick, out of control, type 1 juvenile diabetics. Yeah, their sugar's through the roof, but that's not what's going to kill them. What's going to kill them is acids build up in their blood, and if their pH drops just a little bit too low, they won't have long for this world. You're going to learn how to quickly diagnose and treat those patients so you can save their lives. This is one of those embedded animations. I hope they're working well for you, and I hope you find them useful. First, let's talk about the buffer systems. Key general point, buffers very quickly but temporarily change strong acids or bases into weak ones. So notice the key points, quick and temporary. And it says change. It doesn't say remove. This doesn't remove anything. It just changes from strong to weak. And in the body, of course, we're generally talking about changing a strong acid into a weak one. Because remember, our main problem is we're making acid all day, every day. We better deal with it or we don't make it to the next day. So buffers, it's kind of like a buffer zone in a war zone, right? When you bring in some neutral team in between two fighting factions and create a buffer zone, that's a quick but temporary solution to the problem. So that's the analogy I like to use. There are three buffer systems we'll talk about. This is just a list slide. We'll talk about them one at a time in this order. The phosphate buffer system, the protein buffer system, and the carbonic acid bicarbonate buffer system. First, the phosphate buffer system. Notice this slide and all the slides are pretty much organized the same way. At the top, the name of the system. Next, where the system works, the location of the buffer, where it has most of its action. And then last is described the function of the buffer system. The phosphate buffer system, as far as where it works, it's most important in the ICF, that's the intracellular fluid, and the urine. Okay, this should make sense. Remember we discussed where the ions were located? Remember PPP poking inside the cells? And phosphate was one of those P's inside the cells. So it should make sense that phosphate works as a buffer mostly in the intracellular fluid because that's mostly where it is. And then I remember it helps to buffer our urine because I just remember that this pee is in this pee. And you know, if we didn't have a buffer system in there, our urine would burn even more than maybe it usually does. Okay, how does it work? This is a big picture slide and pretty much will be a recurrent theme for all the slides. I'm not going to ask you to regurgitate the whole formula, but you should be able to recognize and identify the players. So here we go. Here is hydrogen ion. That is strong acid. We're making that all day, every day, and we got to deal with it so we can make it to the next day. Inside of our cells, primarily, we have a buffer. Here it is. It's monohydrogen phosphate because it's got one hydrogen on it. This is a weak base. This buffer, which is a weak base, has the ability to bind, to suck that hydrogen ion out of solution, create a new chemical called dihydrogen phosphate because it has two hydrogens, and it is a weak acid. So what did we do? We mixed a strong acid, that's bad, with a weak base, the buffer. If we mix an acid with a base, what do? We move more towards neutral, a much better situation, and we've created a weak acid. So the buffer quickly but temporarily changed a bad situation to a better situation. Let's next look at the protein buffer system. Key bullet point at the top, if you're ever asked. It's the most abundant buffer in body cells and in the blood. And that should just make sense, because if I were you, I'd write off to the side, proteins are everywhere, so it shouldn't surprise you that it's the most abundant buffer in those locations. Examples you already know about. Hemoglobin is inside of our red blood cells. One of the things hemoglobin did when you studied that protein, of course, it dropped off oxygen to tissue cells, but also what maybe you didn't learn is, while it was doing that, it was also picking up acid from those cells at the same time. Albumin, most common plasma protein in our blood. And again, it is a protein that has the ability to buffer solutions. Let's break it down into the details. To your left is a drawing from your book. I'm not such a big fan of it, but let's start in the middle here. This is the general structure of an amino acid, which makes up proteins. Here's the carbon. There's the variable group. Over to the left side with the N on it is the amino group. I remember it's the amino group because amino has an N in it, and there's the N slapped right there. The amino group has the ability to bind or to suck acid out of solution. Here in pink, from your books drawing is hydrogen ion. That's acid. Remember, we're making acid all day, every day. Got to deal with it. The good news is the amino group can act as the weak base buffer. It can bind to the strong acid and weaken the situation, buffer the situation, and create a much more tolerable situation to the body. And this is mostly what's happening inside of the body as far as the way proteins work. That amino group is sucking that acid out of solution and creating a weak acid by combining the hydrogen ion with our weak base, which is the amino group. Next, remember on your amino acid structure, we have here the COOH group. That is the carboxyl group. That's easier for me to remember because carboxyl has a C in it and this group has a C in it. Now, the carboxyl group can act as a weak acid and buffer an alkaline solution because the carboxyl group can actually let go of this H. It can actually donate that hydrogen ion to solution if needed. Now, that's not the common situation in the body. I want you all to remember the common situation is we're dealing with buffering acids. But there are some cases that come up where we might have an alkaline or a basic body fluid. And the good news about proteins is that they can do double duty. They can deal with both an acidic solution and they can also deal with an alkaline solution. And the carboxyl group, once again, can buffer that alkaline solution by letting go of that hydrogen ion and putting it into solution and therefore buffering the pH. Last but not least, as far as the buffer systems comes, the carbonic acid bicarbonate buffer system. Most people just call this for short the bicarb buffer system. Where does it work? Remember, this is an important regulator of blood pH. I just remember bicarb is a big buffer in the blood. You can read all these words I have typed on the slide here, and we'll fill them in together as I'm talking, but I like to look down here at the formula because this is the key. So here we go. Here's the story, and you should make some notes. Our body's making what all day, every day? Acid, strong acid, symbolized by the H+. And we got to deal with it or we don't make it to the next day. So in the blood, we have our weak base bicarb buffer, HCO3-, which once again can suck that acid out of solution, suck that hydrogen ion and bind it up and create a new chemical, in this case off to your right, H2CO3, which is your old friend carbonic acid, the weak acid. So we did the same thing we've been doing all along. We took a strong acid, we mixed it with our weak base buffer, we neutralized it, we made a bad situation a much better situation by creating a weak acid. Now, this buffer system can also go the other way. I'm going to talk about it, but please, I want you to remember the most common situation in the body is the one we just did. That's why in this figure, I drew the big arrow in bold going towards the right. But yes, if we do have a problem in the body where we have a basic or an alkaline solution, this equation is reversible, so to speak. The carbonic acid, the weak acid, can break apart in solution and donate one of those strong hydrogen ion acids to solution to try to buffer an alkaline solution. Again, not a common scenario in the body, but it could happen. While you're making notes and filling in some blanks, let me give you an example some of you might know. Swimming pools. Maybe you have one, maybe you were a lifeguard, and if so, you might have had to adjust the chemicals. Because when people go in the pool, you don't want their eyes to burn. I like to ask students, what is it in the pool that burns the eyes? And everyone immediately says chlorine. Well, okay, if the chlorine's really high, that could burn your eyes. But most commonly, it's something else. Most commonly, it's the acid-base balance in the pool. It's the acid that burns your eyes. So, if you're like me, and I've worked on swimming pools, what did you do if the pH was too low, which you know means too acidic? You dumped in a powder. The powder was baking soda. And if you look at the box of baking soda you might have at home, it says sodium bicarbonate. That's right. The weak base bicarbonate buffer, that's what's in baking soda. That's why you're dumping in swimming pools to neutralize the acid. So we're done with the buffer systems. They were quick temporary fixes, but didn't really get rid of anything. So now we talk about the body's next mechanism to deal with acid-base problems. And it is exhalation of carbon dioxide. In other words, we can breathe out acid. Yes, breathing plays a huge role in pH balance. It's not as quick as buffers. Buffers, you know, work in fractions of a second. Breathing may take, you know, minutes or longer before it can really kick into gear. Breathing works because breathing can reduce the level of the only volatile acid in the human body, which you know is carbonic acid. So we can reduce carbonic acid in the blood by breathing it out as carbon dioxide. So, some examples coming out. We can modify or change our body's pH by changing the rate and depth of breathing. Example number one. The faster I breathe, of course, the more carbon dioxide I exhale. Again, just think of that as breathing out acid. So, if I breathe out more acid, the acid concentration in my blood decreases. So, if you drew the line I asked you to draw on the first slide, if the acid in the blood decreases, what happens to the blood pH? It rises. Please draw yourself a line from A to B, acid to base, from 0 to 14 with neutral slap in the middle. Let's do another example to see if we really understand this. Let's say I slow my breathing rate down. Let's say I just stop breathing. That's a pretty extreme example. Or maybe you accidentally hit the ventilator button and turn the ventilator off in the ICU. Okay, there's no breathing going on. So let's fill in the blanks here together. In this case, clearly, less carbon dioxide exhaled. If I'm not breathing at all, there's no carbon dioxide exhaled. That means no acid or less acid being exhaled. Therefore, the acid H+ concentration in the blood increases, and therefore the blood pH will decrease. While you're making notes, a couple things on this slide. There's a fancy diagram off to your right. Your book likes to use these. These are okay for some people. Other people don't like them. So you could take it or leave it. There's no really new information there. And at the bottom of the slide is the chemical formula that really explains this whole thing. If you're a purist, if you're a chemist, this explains everything. I'm not going to ask you to regurgitate the formula, but you should know the players. So let's go through it. Let's do it in the direction that's most common. Okay, here we go one more time. Your body's making acid all day, every day. We better get rid of it or we don't make it to the next day. There's the H+. In the blood, we have our weak base bicarb ion, which sucks it up and binds to it and forms a better situation, which is our weak acid called carbonic acid, H2CO3. Then that travels through our blood, into the capillaries, in the lungs, where it breaks down into water and carbon dioxide, which we breathe out to the atmosphere. And again, think of that as breathing out acid. Yes, if we stop breathing, the equation goes the opposite direction. Carbon dioxide combines with water and eventually breaks down into acid into our blood. So this equation, for all you chemists, explains what I just said in words. But again, I'm not going to ask you to write that equation down. Just be able to recognize and know those main players as I discuss them. Well, you might ask yourself, how does the body know to do that? I mean, does that happen just because Dr. Gonchore said it happens? Is it magic? Is it mumbo jumbo? I mean, how does the body know whether to breathe faster or breathe slower? Well, the body's really smart. This is a slide that explains how. And I took a figure from one of the A&P1 chapters. Off to your right, I got the heart with the major vessels coming out the top, including the aorta and carotid arteries. And then at the very top is the brain. So here's the deal. We have special chemical receptors called chemoreceptors. They are lumps of special cells that have the ability to sense or taste chemicals. There are lumps of those cells located in the aorta called aortic bodies. There's lumps of those cells in the carotid arteries that some genius called the carotid bodies. And there's some lumps of those special cells in a part of the brainstem called the medulla. And all of those chemical receptors are especially sensitive to acid, right, H+, and carbon dioxide, which again, think of as acid. So, how are we controlling our breathing? Mostly by sensing acid. Some of you are thinking, oh, I thought it was oxygen that mostly controlled breathing. Yeah, of course it plays a part, but the main thing that controls breathing is acid, chemical receptors for acid. Because we don't want to denature our proteins. We don't want to fry our melon. That would be bad to melt the brain. So, what happens? Well, those chemical receptors, they send their signals to the breathing area called the inspiratory area, which is also conveniently located in the medulla. And that breathing area will adjust how fast and how deep that we breathe depending on the pH. So let's go over to the figure and talk through kind of an example. So here's your heart beating and some blood comes out the aorta and say there's a little bit too much acid. So the aortic bodies, they chemically sense the acid and they say, ooh, taste a little bit of acid here. I don't feel like frying the brain, so I will send signals up these yellow wires to the breathing area in the medulla and tell it to breathe harder and faster. Let's say the blood gets up a little bit further and it's now halfway to the brain because it's at these carotid bodies and they say, ooh, there's still too much acid. We don't want to fry the melon, so I will send a signal through these yellow wires to the breathing area in the medulla to tell our body to breathe harder and faster. And if the blood makes it all the way up to the medulla and still has too much acid, well, we're kind of already at the brain, and the medulla chemical receptors taste it and say, oh, the acid's already arrived. We're about to fry the melon. I'm going to tell myself that we better breathe harder and faster, or we're going to be in big trouble. While you're making notes, I want to give you an example of something that might help you remember this. Have any of you heard of a sport, a very dangerous sport called free diving? That's where divers try to go down as deep as they can, as long as they can, without any scuba gear. And what do they do just before they make that big, deep, long dive? They hyperventilate. Why? Not to raise the oxygen level. Because, you know, if I were to take one of those little oxygen sensors that you might have seen in the ER and put it on your finger and measure the oxygen level of any one of you, it would pretty much measure a saturation of 98, 99% or so. In other words, it's hard to saturate your blood with any more oxygen than it's already saturated with as you're just sitting there. The reason they're hyperventilating is they know this system. They are trying to breathe out as much carbon dioxide and therefore as much acid as possible, because they are going to essentially trick the system. They're going to fake out the system so that when they're on that deep, long dive, they don't want to have their brain tell them to take a breath while they're underwater, because they'll drown. So if they do it properly and hyperventilate properly, and I don't know exactly how to do that, so don't ask me what that is. I've never been a free diver. But if they do it properly, they'll be able to go down, make the dive, and then make it back up to the surface and never have that urge to take the breath. And maybe they'll set some kind of world record. On the other hand, here's what could happen as well. If they breathe out as much acid as possible, they could be down underwater deep. They maybe never get the signal from the brain to take a breath, but they run out of oxygen and pass out underwater. And if you pass out underwater, that's not good, and that's how some of them actually die during that sport. Last but not least, the workhorse of the system, how to deal with acid problems in the body, the kidneys. Kidney excretion of hydrogen ion. In other words, pee out the acid. That's the number one way. Metabolic reactions produce non-volatile acids all day, every day. And renal excretion, peeing it out through the urine. I hope you don't mind me using third grade, you know, kind of talk, but I got a kid at home. That's the only way to eliminate the huge excess of acid from our body. Generally, a very slow process. I mean, this can take days or longer to kick in, but very effective in the long run. And that's why your patients who are in kidney failure can die rapidly due to pH imbalances. And when they go to dialysis and get put on that machine, one of the purposes is, of course, to make sure their blood has the proper pH balance. Now that we talked about some of the basics and you have some of the tools you need, we can start to talk about patient examples. I love to put acid-base imbalance patient examples on the test because they're great, they're real life, and they really show me how much you understand, and you prove to yourself how much you understand. A couple more definitions before we break into the examples. Acidosis. That's a condition where the arterial blood pH is below 7.35. You should know it by heart. Classically, it has been described that patients who are in significant acidosis, well, they get depression of their central nervous system, which can slow their central nervous system enough where they fall into a coma or even die. the way I remember that is, well, if I dump a cup of acid on my head, I'd be really depressed. So that's just a pea brain memorization technique. What about alkalosis? The definition. That's a condition where the arterial blood pH is above 7.45. You gotta know that stone cold. Alkalosis, classically, those patients, if it's significant, they get excitability of their nervous tissue. In other words, exactly the opposite of what acidosis does. Alkalosis causes irritability, excitability of nervous tissue, where the patient can develop spasms, convulsions, and even death from that. How do I remember that? I look at alkalosis. Alkalosis got a K in it. And I just, when I see a K, I think kick. So alkalosis kind of kicks things up a notch. You know, if I have to kick someone, that'll, you know, stimulate the body and excite it and cause them to go into maybe spasms. So that's just my little trick to remember the difference. A couple more definitions. A respiratory condition means there's a problem with the lungs, plain and simple. A metabolic condition means there's a problem with anything else besides the lungs. Keep it that simple and you'll get all the questions right. And more importantly, you'll understand this stuff. So, here's a table from your book. And calm down, you don't have to know it. The whole table, that is. It goes beyond our course. Some of you may be in the respiratory program. You already know this stuff, and it might be below your level. I've highlighted the big things. Over here to your left are the four conditions that your patients may develop as far as acid-base imbalances. And you'll see those four choices on a multiple choice question. Your patient may have a respiratory acidosis, a respiratory alkalosis, a metabolic acidosis, or a metabolic alkalosis. And I'm going to give you a patient scenario, and you're going to have to pick the one out of the four that's the correct one. Common causes, I put a box around. This would be good to read through, and I'm going to give examples of these individually to help with our understanding of this. And let's start right here on this slide. Let's talk about vomiting. Let's say I give someone on the test severe vomiting. How does that affect acid-base balance? Well, what are they vomiting out? A lot of stomach juice. And what's in there? You got it. Strong hydrochloric acid. So they're removing acid from their body. They have less acid in their body. So if I give someone severe vomiting on the test, you're going to have four choices. What do you pick? Well, make it easy. First of all, the problem ain't the lungs. So it can't be any of the respiratory stuff. So you know it has to be metabolic. Now, they're removing acid from their body. So the correct choice would be metabolic alkalosis. Let's keep going. I have plenty more examples to make sure we have this down. How about diarrhea? And you need to write this down. When people have a lot of watery diarrhea, it just so happens they lose a lot of our old friend, the weak base buffer called bicarbonate. So we lose our bicarb buffer in diarrhea. I have a way to remember this, by the way. We lose acid from above and base from below. So we lose acid from above and we lose our bicarb buffer base from our bottom. So now, on the test, I give someone severe watery diarrhea and I say, please tell me which of the following four conditions they develop. Well, it's easy. Right away, you know, it can't be respiratory. It's certainly not a lung problem. So, in this case, we're losing our weak base buffer. We're losing our bicarb. We're losing our ability to deal with acid. We can't neutralize it anymore. So this patient with diarrhea will develop a metabolic acidosis. Let's work through several more examples. I made these slides up. They aren't from the book. I think they're great summary slides for acidosis and alkalosis. So here we go. In summary, if the lungs are not working properly, there is a respiratory problem. For example, if the lungs are damaged from some disease, like emphysema, and it doesn't matter on a test what the disease is. I could break the lungs from anything. Pneumonia, asbestosis, popcorn, lung disease, you name it. It doesn't matter. I'm going to tell you, in a sense, the lungs are broken. They ain't working. Therefore what? Therefore, carbon dioxide and acid will increase in the blood because you're not breathing properly anymore. This will therefore result in a condition, in a problem called what? You got to give me the total name. Okay, let's stop for a second before you shout out a guess. First thing is you got to decide, is it the lungs or not the lungs? It's the lungs, of course, so the first word is respiratory. Then you have to decide, is the patient becoming more acid or not? In this case, they're becoming more acid because they're not breathing it out anymore. The acid's building up in their blood. So the correct answer is respiratory acidosis. Let's do another example. Let's say, on the other hand, the patient was hyperventilating. In other words, they were breathing too fast and too deep. In this case, their lungs are working too good. They're overworking, breathing harder and faster due to anxiety, for example. Maybe you're nervous about the final exam, or maybe you accidentally bump the switch in the ICU and you double the rate and depth of the ventilation on poor Mr. Jones. Well, in this case, what's happening? Carbon dioxide is getting blown off to the atmosphere. More acid is getting blown off to the atmosphere. Please think of carbon dioxide as acid. Therefore, in this case, we will decrease the acid in the blood, resulting in a condition, a problem, called what? Let's take it slow. First word, you got to decide, is it the lungs or not the lungs? It's the lungs, so it's a respiratory problem. Second word, we have to decide, are we becoming more acid or less acid? In this case, we're blowing the acid out of our body by breathing out so much carbon dioxide. So the correct total condition is respiratory alkalosis. Those patients typically will get a little numb and tingly. You might have heard of that. And the treatment in the ER, you may have seen this, they have them breathe into a paper bag. Why do they do that? Because they're rebreathing the carbon dioxide, the acid, back into their body, and that will hopefully help correct the imbalance that they gave themselves. On this slide, let's discuss some other situations. Let's say any other parts of the body besides the lungs are broken. Then there is what kind of problem? A metabolic problem, because it ain't the lungs. For example, let's say on the test I damage the kidneys. It doesn't matter how I break them. I could give somebody diabetes on the test, lupus, high blood pressure, kidney cancer. Maybe I'll just take the kidneys out on the test. Who knows? So what? Then the kidneys will not be able to get rid of acid. This will result in a condition, a problem called what? Let's break it down. It ain't the lungs, so first word, metabolic. acid is building up in our body, so it's acidosis. Total answer is metabolic acidosis. On the other hand, let's say a person takes too many antacids. You told the patient, take two antacids a day. And the patient said to themselves, well, if two a day is good, maybe 22 a day is even better. So what did they do by overdosing on antacids? They neutralized the acid in their stomach and essentially in their body. Think of that as they got acid, took acid out of their body by neutralizing it. So therefore, the acid level in the blood will decrease, resulting in a condition, in a problem, totally called what? Metabolic, because it ain't the lungs. Alkalosis, because we took acid out of the body. Let me give you a second example. Let's say you're a nurse on the floor, and two people quit, two are on vacation, and one's on a break. So you're going really fast that day, and you ignore or forgot to see the order on the chart that said discontinue the nasogastric suctioning on Mr. Jones. What that is there's a tube running through his nose into his stomach, sucking out his stomach juice. There are certain diseases like pancreatitis where you might do that. And the stomach juice ends up in this big canister on the wall, and you can see the stomach juice in there. Well, let's say, again, you forgot or missed the order. And you come back 3 days later, and there's stomach juice filling up. The canister is overflowing on the floor. What did you do to poor old Mr. Jones by overly aggressively sucking out his stomach juice? Well, you took acid out of his body. So once again, what condition does he have out of the four? He has metabolic alkalosis. Run through those problems over and over again. You should be able to get them right. I hope you get a really good understanding of this, because it just has such great clinical application in the real world.